Hi, my name's Sandy Adams, and I've been researching Agenda 21 and 2030 for the last, well, certainly Agenda 21 for the last 12 years, and I've seen it in action here when the Somerset levels flooded, and I've also worked with the people, with the corporations that are rolling this out. Originally, I was a set designer in corporate live events, and I worked on installations for Bill Gates, with Microsoft. I met him. I've met Eric Schmidt. I worked for Google. I've worked for all the bad guys, GlaxoSmithKline, Michael Bloomberg. And I absolutely had an enormous break. Well, I thought it was a breakdown, but it was a breakthrough in 2008, 2009, where I decided I couldn't work with these people anymore. And I literally changed my life. I ended up going through a divorce and moving away from London. And I really went down the rabbit hole. And so here I am now. I've got a website.
Sandy, can I just ask you, what was the moment you realised that you couldn't work with these people anymore?
Well, it was, I'll tell you, it was a, when I worked on these installations for Bill Gates, he actually did fly into the one we did in Chelsea, and it was really a big installation with sort of focusing on how this technology. First of all, we did Microsoft Home, which was a house we took over and made avail. It was a house of a billionaire, and we took it over, wired it all up with all the technology, intelligent fridges, intelligent everything, and it was such a success that we then had to do Microsoft Life, which was taking over a school in Chelsea and turning it into a London square with businesses and houses around it, showcasing all the technology. And that's when Bill Gates flew in from Battersea in a helicopter and got chauffeured to Chelsea, and we met him. But to be honest, my biggest breakthrough, and I was beginning to feel very uneasy about it. Even when I met him, I just had not a good feeling about him. And I found that I was working for the real breakthrough when I was working for GlaxoSmithKline, and I had to attend a meeting at their offices on the West Way. It was a big glass building that they've got there, and I was in a meeting with my producer, because I worked for a live events company at the time, and they were having a sort of like a brainstorm about this particular product. I can't even remember what it was now, but it was about penetrating the Ayurvedic market with this product, and I just went into a kind of a reaction, I suppose, and I walked out of the meeting, and my producer said, what's the matter? Why did you walk out? And I said, they're trying to penetrate the Ayurvedic market with pharmaceuticals. And she said, what's that? And I suddenly thought, I'm in the wrong game, it was a slow process of realizing I was working for the dark side, if you like.
So can you just explain what the Ayurvedic market is and what they were trying to do?
Well, the Ayurvedic market system in India is a medicinal, a holistic medicinal system based on using herbs and all sorts of healing properties, and it's an individual thing. It's based on the person, whether they're a certain type of body type or whatever, and it's the Ayurvedic doctors, and it's something in India that they use before they actually. Only if they have something really, really wrong do they go into an allopathic medicine, like an operation or something. But in general, their kind of medicine system is really Ayurvedic. They will go to an Ayurvedic doctor first for something that possibly is not not acute, but chronic. It might be arthritis, it might be whatever. An Ayurvedic doctor will deal with that very successfully.
So, are they using things like natural medicines, or what is it? Is it or physical, like a chiropractor or something?
It's natural medicines, yeah. It's natural medicines that they use. It's herbal stuff that they use, and it's a very successful. It's been the Ayurvedic medicine has been a part of the Indian culture for thousands of years.
Well, I mean, you must have had some doubts about the pharmaceutical industry in the West. Balked against that, you know, the idea that these things that you didn't like in the West were going to be, you know, there was going to be an attempt to sort of swamp the Indian market with this stuff. So,
I think I've always been skeptical about the pharmaceutical industry really leading the way. With health, because it's often the doctors and the GPs are compromised because they're rewarded for putting out certain pharmaceuticals, and it's an industry. And it's quite controlled, I think.
Well, yeah. The big pharmaceutical companies, some of them say in their annual reports openly that what they're trying to do is to get people dependent on their medicines. So they don't actually really want to cure people. What they really love is chronic illnesses, which last for decades, and that they can supply the medicines to people for a very long time. So there's a profit motive in actually not curing people, but in making people dependent, say, you know, like heroin addicts or something, but on medicinal drugs. That's part of their business model. But anyway, look, we're in a very interesting situation with the COVID at the moment, in that quite a lot of people are saying that they think it's mostly gone, and yet there's still this sort of daily panic on the news about the country's about to be overwhelmed again, maybe. There's all sorts of questions about lockdowns, whether they work or not. So if they do work, then how come we're still having them? And if they don't work, then what's the point of having them in the first place? So there's a sort of basic hypocrisy at the root of this policy. And in the background, we've got the big changes going on with the Great Reset looming, which is, it's almost, an audacious act to sort of have a problem and then for someone to say, well, actually, I've got my solution for it at the same time. And some of the people like Gates seem to be engaged with both the problem and the solution. Anyway, so it's fascinating that you actually met Bill Gates.
Yeah.
You did say, you know, you felt a bit uncomfortable with the guy. What did you actually have a chat with him, or what, you know, what was it like meeting him?
No, it wasn't a chat. It was more like, everybody lined up and shook his hand. And I'd been working as, as the stylist, if you like, and the designer on the look of this whole installation. And we had to sort of like meet him. And, you know, there were lots of PAs who, you know, on the side of my team who were looking after his needs and stuff. And he just was very aloof, very robotic. And I just got a really weird feeling from him. But that's just personal. That's not, you know, at the time I just thought, what a weird guy. And I thought, well, maybe he's, you know, he just was, you know, he's a geeky guy, you know, and they are, you know, possibly, I don't know. I felt he was possibly quite reserved and just didn't communicate very well.
Yeah, anyway, so I mean, you've been speaking during these lockdown protests at various places. But what I'm intrigued at, I mean, you've been talking about something called Agenda 21, which I can remember being coming, I think it was from Brazil about 1993, the idea of having an environmental agenda for the planet to kind of clean the planet up. Pollution and this sort of thing. So you've been talking about Agenda 21, but we're now in 21, aren't we, 2021, and there's something new coming along to sort of take it on called Agenda 2030. So my main question for you, Sandy, is how is this all connected, do you think, with the pandemic that's been going on and the COVID stuff? Because Agenda 21 is, you know, for most people, I think we've thought of this as something which is actually quite benign and fairly positive, the idea that there are some people out there who are looking out for the planet.
Well, you know, it's interesting how Agenda 21 was the agenda for the 21st century, which is what we are in now. And it was launched at the Earth Summit in 1992 by basically, it was Maurice Strong, who's a very interesting character. I don't know if you know anything about him, but he was the granddaddy of Agenda 21. He was an interesting character. He was very charismatic. He'd been born in poverty in Canada in the 1930s and had worked his way up and managed to work for the Rockefellers. He started very lowly, and he managed to work his way up in the banking system with the Rockefellers. And he became very, very influential. And then he became Secretary General of the United Nations. But he'd always had this plan in his head, and it was for global, a one world government, a one world government, a one world currency, one world religion, one world everything. And he managed to, when he was in the United Nations, he pulled together a whole load of Club of Rome reports, and they came out at different times, and I'll tell you about those. And the first one was really he wrote it himself with Gro Harlem Brundtland, and there were the and it was called Our Common Future, and it was how to actually shift the power from the West to the East. The economic power, and financing the poorer nations. And it was put forward as a kind of, you know, a benefit for the poorer countries, for India and China and the Eastern countries that weren't, or they called it the non-developed countries, and the West being the what he called the polluters and the consumers would make reparations. It was almost like a second Marshall Plan to shift money from Europe over to the East. But what I don't think what anybody realised that it didn't actually end up in the hands of the poor people. It ended up in the hands of the tech people to create cheap labour, to create the AI that we're now, which is what the Fourth Industrial Revolution is all about now. So that was one of the first Club of Rome reports. Well, actually, before that, there was one called Limits to Growth, which was all about population and how population needed to be brought under control. And that was in 1971. Incidentally, it was at a time when there was, I think it was Ehrlich was writing, was it Paul Ehrlich, was writing about the population bomb, which never happened. You know, it was a load of false data about overpopulation and how, you know, in the next 10 years we'd be so overpopulated that, you know, the world wouldn't be able to function. And a lot of that, you know, has come and gone. And in fact, we're in decline in the West, particularly as far as population goes. We're not even at replacement value rates at the moment. So so 1971 you had Limits to Growth, and Maurice Strong was pulling all these together. 1971, Limits to Growth, 1987 was Our Common Future, and then the final Club of Rome report, which really brought together all that they needed for the Earth Summit, was one called the First Global Revolution, where in that think tank they were trying to figure out a way how they would actually bring the whole of society together with a common threat. And in there, in that report, and you can buy it online if you want to, it's called The First Global Revolution. It's written by somebody called Alexander Schneider, and I can't remember the other guy's name. But anyway, it on page, I think it's 115 of that, it actually says, you know, we thought about, you know, famine, flooding, da 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 da, whatever, but we actually decided that global warming would fit the bill. So actually, it's even in black and white there that the Club of Rome were trying to, and they said it would be a global crisis that would need a global response, and what they said at the end of that paragraph was, so actually, humanity is the enemy. That the enemy is humanity itself. And I mean, I can get that quote for you right now, but I mean, I think it's wasting time looking up. But that was the gist of it. And you can find all this information on my website anyway, which I'll tell you about at the end. And so, with all that information, they then sort of at that point in 1992, a very strange thing happened with the Ecology Party. The Ecology Party was a really proper green organization trying to say really save you know, conservation and really all the good stuff. So it, at that point, it wasn't taken over. But what happened in the early 90s was that the Green Party got taken over by the United Nations, and it actually, they started bringing in green lobbyists and all sorts of things to the Earth Summit, and activists, and George Soros paid, or a lot of it was paid for by George Soros. The activists were paid activists to bring about this whole lobbying at the Earth Summit to get 179 countries to sign up to Agenda 21, which was all about, you know, basically man is bad for the planet, has to be removed from nature and put into smart cities. And the rest of the world has to be rewilded, which we're now finding. You know, you'll find Boris Johnson saying 30-40% of the British Isles has to be rewilded, and they're pushing this whole smart city agenda. And in Agenda 21, if you read it, and you can read it, it's a 42-chapter document that you can buy on the internet. It sounds very worthy, as all of their stuff does. It sounds really, really worthy that they're doing a good thing. But actually, underneath it is control, and it's all about control of everything on this planet.
Well, one of the interesting an anecdote, I suppose, is back in the late 1990s, I was asked up to a conference in Scotland. It was called Reforesting Scotland, that was a fantastic group of people that had been brought together, possibly with Soros money, I'm not quite sure what, from all over the country, looking at this whole idea of I suppose the ecological future for Scotland, and looking at forests and as a very good thing. And one of the guys that came to speak at that, he was into this whole rewilding thing, and he was saying, well, what you really need to do is to get whole areas of particularly the highlands, which are forested, and to prevent people from sort of living there or going walking there and this sort of thing, in order to allow some of these old species to kind of come back. And there was a great tall, dark-haired man from Neudart stood up in the, just as this guy was finishing his talk, he was an English guy, and he said, what do you think you're doing as an Englishman? I won't do the accent. Yes. Coming up here and telling us that we cannot walk in our own country and we cannot live in our own country. We've got a history of the clearances in the Highlands. And I don't think it's at all appropriate for an Englishman to be telling Scots people that they can't live in their own country. So, I mean, this is kind of... He got some sort of idiot of the conference award from the organisers, because he had gone down like a lead balloon, his talk. But this is being taken quite seriously, isn't it, Sandy? That there are people out there that want to separate out large areas and actually do things like, I mean, you can hardly believe it, reintroduce wolves. This is something that's been in the news. Now, these are actually very dangerous animals. If you know, when they get together, they can kill people. They can certainly kill children. And it does seem to me strange that this seems to be there seems to be some sort of real push for this. But you're talking about people being removed from the countryside as well. Echoes with history and the enclosures and the whole idea of putting people into cities to work in industry during the agricultural and industrial revolutions, you know, which is where this whole idea of the dark satanic mills comes from. So can you just say something about that? Because at the moment, I'm wondering, you know, we don't have industries really anymore. And most of our cities have become unpleasant because they were designed to be worked, you know, to have lots of people working in industries in them. And yet now most of those industries are gone, and those cities are kind of looking for a purpose. They have no purpose anymore. And most of the people would rather live in more pleasant surroundings, you know, so long as they're economically able to, in the countryside, which is actually a much nicer place to bring the kids up and that sort of thing. So I'm quite amazed to hear you talking about people being removed from the countryside and put in cities. We've got a history, a very oppressive history of that happening. And also, what are they supposed to do in these so-called smart cities?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, the thing is that the smart cities are there to really control. I mean, Bristol, for instance, is the flagship smart city of Europe, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And they've put a lot of infrastructure in there. You know, the Internet of Things is being developed in there, and they've put in a lot of. They've got. I mean, I was just amazed. I mean, they've actually had a company called Hello Lamppost put in interactive street furniture to make it a playable city, so that people can talk to street furniture. But actually, in reality, it's spyware. And there's a lot. There's a lot happening in Bristol, and I know you're in Bristol, so do go into it, because Bristol is Open was the company that were actually putting the infrastructure in. And I realized that actually these smart cities are being built. But during COVID, it's interesting that most people fled the cities and wanted to be in the countryside, because our city, I mean, London at the moment is like a ghost town. It's, I mean, the atmosphere is dreadful. And there will be a means that, I mean, this is me just thinking out of the box. Because their biggest drive is to get people from the countryside into the cities, it's my view, and I have written a paper about it on the on my website, because I thought, how are they going to achieve this? How are they going to get? Because the idea is to literally make the countryside a lot, you know, not available to the you know, to the people. And we're talking about, I don't know what kind of time span they've got on this. I really don't. But what will happen is that I was looking at the United Nations website, and I don't know if it's still there because I haven't looked lately, at the zoonotic diseases bit on their website. But they started talking about the countryside being a very dangerous place for human beings, but also in the same breath saying human beings ruin the countryside. Now, this is on the United Nations website, and and under their environmental program section. And so I thought, hang on a minute. So, and then they were talking about how dangerous it was, because nasty, dangerous pathogens lie in plants and animals, and that actually humans shouldn't really, for their own benefit, be in the countryside. But also, it's a two-way thing. Humans are really bad for the countryside because they destroy it. And I thought, what they could easily do, and they you know, this COVID thing will not go away unless we really, really have a big push to reveal the truth, and we're doing our best. But the fact is that at some point they will release something or invent something that is mythical, a bit like what we have now, of some deadly disease that actually is in the country. It could be anthrax, it could be brucellosis, it could be anything that's in livestock, because also they want to get rid of the meat industry and get us all eating God knows what it is. It's fake stuff. And, you know, it is pretty hideous, but I really think that in order to accelerate this in the same way as COVID was used to accelerate the 17 goals of Agenda 21, or Agenda 2030, sorry, not Agenda 21. And I'll talk about how 21 became 30 in a minute, if you like, because I don't want to get too sidetracked. But at the moment, I honestly believe that there will be a push to get everybody out of the countryside. Because
okay, well, look, can you talk about how these aims are being accelerated by COVID? Because I think we really need to establish what is the link between the Agenda 21, Agenda 2030 and COVID.
Okay, well, Agenda 21, as I say, was launched at the Earth Summit in 1992. By coercion, I believe. And this whole idea that if you don't do this, the planet will die. And this is what they invited world leaders of every country to that Earth Summit. And of course, everybody thought that you know, this was going to save the planet. We have to sign up to Agenda 21 in order to, you know, sustainable development is the way to go. We have to sign up. So 179 countries signed up to Agenda 21. It's in every town council in the UK. the policies of Agenda 21. And, you know, it's global. So it's in every sort of town council in, you know, the equivalent in America or wherever. A few states in America have opted out of Agenda 21 and have battled to do so, mainly Texas and the southern states, where they're very, very tied to the constitution and their land and their property rights. You know, they're very, very into their property rights. We've kind of lost track of our property rights at the moment, because another thing about Agenda 21 is that nobody owns anything. And it's interesting that that is what Klaus Schwab is saying about the fourth industrial revolution. You will own nothing and you will be happy. And this is unfortunately, you know, what they want is actually.
But how does this link up with the pandemic?
Well, I'll tell you, Agenda 21 became Agenda 2030. I'll move along in the timeline, actually. Agenda 21 was 1992. It became Agenda 2030 in 2015, when President Obama came to Rome, and it was endorsed by the Pope. It was a very underreported event. It was on, I think it was the 15th of September, 2015, where what they did was they decided to accelerate Agenda 21 by creating 17 goals that would have to be achieved by 2030. Because to be honest, since 1992, none of the goals had been achieved. It had been very, very slow on the uptake of countries to understand and to get on board with, you know, with the fact that you know, in their view, the planet would die through global warming, which, you know, is provably. I mean, this whole thing about being a climate denier, as you mentioned earlier, you know, the fact is that our planet at the moment is in a period of cooling. But you cannot tell that to anyone, because on the mainstream media, everyone is, you know, is talking about it heating up, and that we've got a very short time left before our planet will be so hot that, you know, we won't be able to function. And unfortunately, it was all based on global, you know, the Earth Summit and 2030. Is based on the fact that, you know, we've got to save the planet, we've got to stop the planet from heating. Therefore, you have to stop flying, you have to stop using your cars, you have to conserve your energy in your home, you've got to insulate everything. And it's very, I mean, in a way, this fits totally in with what's happening now, because the COVID has forced everyone not to fly, not to drive, to stay indoors. It's actually having that effect. But what they did, instead of saying, if you don't do X, Y, and Z, you will, you know, the planet will die, it's if you don't do X, Y, and Z, you will die. And that has really worked. That has worked a treat.
We know this week, don't we? They've just introduced these 2-week compulsory quarantine for people flying into the UK. I mean, you can kind of see in the background, can't you, that all these climate goals, this actually helps fulfill them, because if you're dissuading people from flying, if you're penalising people £2,000 every time they fly, this is like a tax which will only allow the wealthy to fly. This is going to massively reduce your carbon footprint but with the aircraft, so you're reaching your climate goals by doing this. And I don't see any of that as part of the critique and the coverage of it on the mainstream press at all. Are there any other things, do you think, you know, like cashless, increasing cashless, that may fit in with Agenda 21 that the pandemic has been pushing?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of Agenda 21, 2030 is that if you look at the goals there, most of them are based on equality and poverty and food security, all the things that they want to be in charge of. And being in charge of poverty, which I will talk about with the impact investing, is a big part of it, and why they need the surveillance put in. And this is a really worrying part of it for our children, and, you know, the generations to come, if this continues. And the thing is that what we find is that these goals of Agenda 21 are 2030 are really they sound, it's almost like they're sugar coated. They sound really good. For instance, you know, end poverty, equality for women, and a lot of it's based on equality and poverty and food. And you know, obviously there's other ones. I mean, do look at them yourself. But what I'm finding, what if you interpret it, it's about control of everything. And these goals to be achieved by 2030 are really about restricting people's movement, you know, whether that's globally or even locally. You know, it's about conserving energy and creating, the whole thing about ending poverty. What they really want is poverty for all, and that would end poverty because nobody will own anything. So we'll all be, you know, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. And this is the whole idea of what they're trying to achieve. Now, it's interesting that if you look at all of these, all these things that the Agenda 21 seeks to achieve, it's being achieved by this COVID pandemic. And then you've got the link between the World Economic Forum. Interestingly enough, the World Economic Forum held an event in, I think it was the Johns Hopkins Institute in New York. And this is in June of 2019, so before the pandemic actually sort of hit. And they held this scenario, a tabletop scenario. Event 201 was a tabletop exercise held at the Johns Hopkins Institute in New York on September the 15th, 2019, I can't remember the date, but anyway, it's in 2019, and it was June in 2019. And what happened was that they held this 3-day scenario event of what, and it was the World Economic Forum and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So those two organizations got together to create this event. And so it was obvious that what with the World Economic Forum being in cahoots with the United Nations in creating also the lockstep document. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's a document that was made a little bit earlier. I think it was quite a few years earlier, and I can't recall the date. And that was all about if a pandemic happened, how they would deal with it and create this kind of lockstep, more authoritarian way of controlling the population, and there would be pushback. And they held that quite a few years prior to that. Then that was the United Nations using that idea. And then of course you had event 201 with the World Economic, the lockstep was the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, and then the event 201 was the World Economic Forum with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And when you realize that they all share a facility in Woking in Surrey, which is where the patent for the virus originated, that's a Purbright Institute, by the way, in Woking.
You can't patent a virus, surely?
Well, they patented the vaccine. Sorry, the vaccine. Vaccine was painted. Sorry, I didn't mean the virus.
And so, who is this Purbright Institute? That sounds like it's worthy of a bit more investigation.
Yes. I mean, do look at it, because I'm doing so much that I can't. Sometimes I lose. You know, I'm doing a lot of stuff, and the Purbright Institute is in Woking, and it's a facility that's owned by the MOD, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and I can't remember who else owns it. I think it's just the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the MOD. And it's where the patent for the vaccine was actually was made in, I think it was 2018. So this
is which vaccine?
The COVID vaccine.
Well, there's lots of different ones, aren't there?
Well, I don't. Well, all I know is that if you look up the Purbite Institute, you'll see that it's for experimentation on vaccines. But that is where there was a patent. I think I may have even got it on my website. There was a patent actually created there for something which Bill and Melinda Gates and the MOD had, well, I don't know whether the MOD were involved. Bill and Melinda Gates actually had it patented there.
Well, I know one of the other people involved in Purbright is the royal family through the Crown Estates.
I mean, it's something that I found and I thought that's really interesting
What does the exercise prove, if anything? I mean, of course, there are going to be people out there, you know, making sure that if there is some sort of disease starts spreading around the world, that we've got, you know, at least we have some sort of plan as to how to respond.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's almost impossible to argue with. Some people are so programmed that they're not going to listen. But if you look at the overall deaths, as we know, of people in, for instance, just take this country, the overall deaths with the Office of National Statistics are no different to the deaths in 2018, 2017, 2019. Very little difference. And yet you'll find that the reasons why people have died, COVID, everybody's died of COVID. Nobody, you know, the flu, heart disease, cancer, everything else seems to have disappeared, not disappeared, but certainly reduced. So how they can't actually manipulate the overall figures of deaths. But that's what has happened, is that they're calling, you know, the whole PCR testing is creating what they call cases. And of course, they're pushing out all these, oh, we've had so many cases and this cases and that cases. But actually, there's, you know, this, the PCR tests and the flow tests and the PCR tests aren't accurate, as we know. And they're giving out false positives, false negatives. And I think this is the idea, is to conflate and confuse and reinvent statistics. And that's what we're living with at the moment. And now they've even confused the whole vaccine thing with these different vaccines. You've got Moderna, you've got Pfizer, you've got Oxford, you've got all these different ones. And worse than that, they're mixing them up. So you might get your first injection with Pfizer and your second one with Moderna. And yet they're made differently. And this and we've had endless cases of people being neurologically damaged by these vaccines, and people dying after having them.
That's right. I mean, they've just brought out this week, haven't they, the adverse reactions to the vaccines, which are pretty horrendous. I mean, the idea really here is if you're going to have a vaccine, you want to be protected from illness. You don't want to either be dying after you've had the vaccine or injured by it in any way, really. The whole point of having it is if it's actually going to work. And I think one of the things for me which has been shocking about this way that the mass media has handled all this and the government is that they haven't really talked at all about taking pills to boost your immune system. Basic stuff like we all know having an orange helps you fight a cold. Maybe it will mean that the cold isn't quite so bad if you've had a lot of vitamin C. You know, these things are obvious to children, and yet the mass media has completely steered away from talking about vitamin C, talking about vitamin D, talking about ivermectin, zinc. Ivermectin is that doctors are not getting any reply from Sage when they're writing to them saying we think that you've got up to 90% of people are recovering quickly when they're given ivermectin at the early stages of COVID. And yet Jeremy Greenstock, who's on Sage, who's also the boss of the Wellcome Foundation, he's just ignored the letters. So there's all sorts of questions out there about, you know, the procedures by which the pharmaceutical industry has gotten into the position through the scientific advisory groups that they are trying to completely control the science. In other words, saying that there is no second opinion allowed. We have decided what is the truth, what is the diagnosis, ladies and gentlemen, and we're just carrying on without anybody, any of the other doctors. We're going to ignore them all. You know, so we've got a similar thing going on with the BBC, saying things like we are refusing to allow anybody on who criticizes vaccines, calling them anti-vaxxers, anyone that questions climate change. The BBC's official policy now is that anybody that questions this science is banned. Now, the fact is that the only way science has ever evolved and changed and grown and been successful in the past is when it's been people challenging the orthodoxy, you know, even people like Copernicus saying, actually, folks, the Earth is going around the sun, not the other way around. You know, he's burnt at the stake for it, this kind of thing. So science is always, and I can remember as a teenager doing A-level physics with my maths teacher, Martin Black, bless him, a Jewish maths teacher, saying to us, well, anybody that ever tells you that they know what's going on, that they've got the facts and as a scientist, is lying to you, because science is not about knowing the facts. It's all about theories and speculation about what might be going on. And so any scientist that tells you that they know what's happening is lying. I thought it was quite, I never forgot that.
Because the science is never settled, and that's that the problem is that they're saying it is settled. It's settled, and you know, there's been all sorts of ways of debunking the whole global warming thing. Well, for a start, they changed it from global warming to climate change. That was very convenient because the climate's always changing. It's that's the nature of the climate, you know, and in that sense, this, you know, science is never settled because it's always in flux, it's always in flow, doing something else different. But the fact is that you know, global temperatures have gone down, and that, you know, Michael Mann managed somehow to manipulate the figures and create the hockey stick, you know, from the, I don't know if you know about the hockey stick.
But, yeah, just explain that briefly, because it's quite important, isn't it?
Well, it was, I'm just trying to remember all the facts, actually, because I was doing this on a big PowerPoint, which I haven't done for a number of years because we've been in lockdown. But basically, ClimateGate happened in 2009, where a whole load of emails were hacked by an American source, which is thought to be probably why Julian Assange was locked up. But anyway, an American source hacked into the Hadley Research Centre and the, I think it was the University of East Anglia, where all of this climate research was, that was the hub of it. And they were pushing a lot of, because if you imagine when they created the Earth Summit, they also created the IPCC to back up their false data, you know, or false science on climate change, on global warming as it was then. And so what's happened is that this hacker hacked into the whole server at these two institutions, the Hadley Research Centre for I think it was climate change or global warming then, and the East Anglia University, where there was a particular guy called Michael Mann who was in charge of it. And he had in these emails, he'd said, we have to hide the decline, because basically what they'd done is that, you know, things like the ice core samples were coming out of some research which proved that the cycles of warming and cooling had been going on for many, many, many years. I mean, thousands of years. And in fact, you know, we were in just a cycle that was going upwards, and now it's going downwards. And he said, we have to hide the decline. And there was other emails that were, and also they said, you know, we have to create, we have to change the graph and make it go up instead of down, which is what they were publishing to the people and to the mainstream media, was that the temperatures were going down, but in fact going up, but in fact they were going down. And they call it the hockey stick because he actually changed the data into a sort of an upward trend, which was shaped like a hockey stick. And actually that's been challenged in the court and won. And I can't remember the date of it, but do look up Climategate, anyone that's listening, because...
Yes, what you're saying, it seems to me, is that global warming and climate change is a hoax.
Yes.
So why?
But why? Well, it's to get everybody on board to save the planet. Now, this was what was going on in around 2009. Since the Earth Summit. Since the Earth Summit, it's been pushed that global warming is happening, the planet is dying, and that we have to. And this is why Greta Thunberg was brought in, financed by George Soros and all that lot. She was there wagging her finger, saying, you know, you've got to stop using your cars, you've got to stop flying around the world, and you've got to stop doing this and stop doing that because of global warming. Or they didn't call it global warming, they called it climate change, which isn't nonsense. So what happened is that didn't work. So what they had to do then was bring something else in to accelerate that ideology. And what they did was they brought in the pandemic. I mean, I'm just trying to think, there was something that happened. Yes, it was we've got event 201. Yes, this is it. At one point in June 2019, before the pandemic, if you like, the World Economic Forum and the United Nations signed a deal to accelerate the goals of Agenda 21 2030 in New York. It was called the Strategic Partnership Framework between Antonio Guterres of the United Nations. He was the Secretary General. I think he was the Secretary of the United Nations, and Klaus Schwab. So at some point, they decided in June 2019 that the World Economic Forum and the United Nations got together to accelerate the goals of Agenda 21 2030 in New York.
Well, and but this is actually a partnership agreement you're talking about here between the World Economic Forum and the UN. I mean, mm-hmm. The UN, of course, is a sort of sacrosanct body, really, which was created after the Second World War in order to try and stop wars going on, mainly, you know, obviously there's loads of other sides to it. But that was the main object through creation of the General Assembly of the United Nations with a representative of each country and the Security Council, which has all the major superpowers on there and also a rotating membership. But this is effectively a kind of, I mean, obviously most people realise that the United Nations is not in charge. They are, that they try and tell various countries to do things, but most of the nations are actually sovereign and they don't necessarily do what they're told by the UN, as we saw, for example, when there was a vote against the Iraq war and Blair and Bush decided to go in to invade Iraq anyway.
Yes.
So this is a partnership agreement, Sandy, but it's not really an equal one because the World Economic Forum is absolutely loaded with cash, including a whole load of private banks who can just literally, you know, like you and I sit on a computer and press a button and make up $1 billion if they want and lend it, or $1 trillion. They make money up out of nowhere. That's what they do, and lend it out at interest. And so these banks are absolutely loaded with money, whereas actually, the United Nations is rather strapped for cash at the moment, and they have a great deal of difficulty in sort of ticking over month on month. So it's quite clear who's got the upper hand in that partnership.
Oh, 100%. You see, the thing is that the United Nations was always designed actually to create, I think, this global governance over a long time frame. I mean, if apparently, I mean, the United Nations Charter was literally, some of it was lifted from the Communist Manifesto, believe it or not. So if you look at the United Nations Charter, a lot of it is about, equality, you know, keep making everybody equal and creating and getting rid of sovereign nations. Because what they do, I mean, I have to say what I want my own.
I'm going to butt in there because I don't think there's anything about that in the UN charter where they're talking about getting rid of countries. I mean, what they're doing in the UN was put together and the charter was written up after World War II in good faith, really, saying, well, that was a terrible, terrible war. We need to have some kind of forum where individual nations can come along and at least talk things through. I mean, we might not be able to stop a war, but at least we're going to provide a place where at least that might be possible. And I don't think the UN has ever really, I mean, it may be that's the way it will go, but it's never, certainly in any of its history, since, the 1960s at least, when the Secretary General was assassinated, Dag Hammarskjöld, they haven't really got anywhere close to being a world government, nowhere near. I mean, most of the countries just cock a snook at the UN when they tell them to do something.
Well, you see, my view of the UN is, I'm not sure I agree entirely with you. I do think that they're not what people think they are, because what's happened, a lot of the peacekeeping has actually caused more civil wars, to be honest, and there's also been a lot of horrendous stuff going on with children with the UN, and I'm sorry to say that, but I don't trust the UN at all. I think it's probably did start out as some sort of thing that would sort out all these wars that were occurring in Europe and all that kind of stuff and everywhere, all over the world. And it was set up to create peace. But I don't believe that is necessarily the case. And I think their collaboration with the World Economic Forum is all part of that, if you like.
The World Economic Forum is Davos. We know it as Davos, don't we? It's this amazing meeting of all the wealthiest people in the world that happens at the end of every January up in the Swiss mountains. And I do always think, well, this is why they're having this meeting, is to make sure there's no protesters there, because they'd have to survive in freezing cold conditions on the top of an icy mountain in a tent, and there wouldn't be anywhere for them to stay. So that's a great place to hold a meeting that no protesters can come and annoy them. But anyway, that's just finished, hasn't it, in 2021. We've just had the World Economic Forum. They did it all on Zoom, apparently.
Well, I got very bored. I kind of logged into it, and I got so bored I didn't really listen to much of it. And also, it was time. It went on for quite a few, quite a few days. So I just thought, I don't know, because I don't know what went on in that, and I should do. But I've just been so busy with other things. But what I really feel is important is the World Economic Forum, and they're quite open about this on their website, is that they want to get rid of GDP. GDP is a thing of the past, and they're very open about what they're going to replace it with, which is stakeholder capitalism, or what they call surveillance capitalism. And so this pandemic, if you want to call it that, it is creating an environment where the economy is being crashed with a legitimate reason, and everybody's going along with it. All the businesses are closing down. Now, they've said GDP is a thing of the past, and we will create a new economy. Now, that new economy is going to bring in a far more control over the populations of the world than any capitalism. You know, they're saying capitalism bad. We're going to have happitalism, because everybody will be equal. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy. And the United Nations have got that on their website as well. Happitalism, not capitalism. So suddenly, capitalism as we know it, and we know it's wrong, it's got its faults, but at least you have free enterprise and you have freedom attached to it. But the World Economic Forum wants to crash all that. They want to crash the global economy and replace it with surveillance capitalism, because then they are in charge and it's akin to the Chinese social credit system. And it's all going to be done through the AI. Really, it's bringing in a whole new system of economy. You know, it's creating this system which is based on data and harvesting your data.
Well, hang on. I mean, surely, you know, most people would agree that something's terribly wrong with the global economy. It's not really delivering the goods. It's not delivering jobs for people. You know, it is money is becoming almost a way of controlling people or enslaving people rather than, you know, liberating us. You know, money should be there really to do that, to serve people, you know, and something needs to change. And I think many people, probably the vast majority of the world's population, if they were to actually be asked, would say that we need some sort of great reset.
Well, yeah, we do. But the thing is, I see this more as a spiritual. I mean, I have to say this. I mean, I'm not going woo woo on you, but I see this as humanity's challenge right now, and it's almost like a spiritual challenge. And at the moment, we're on a precipice. We're on a sort of knife edge, on a razor's edge, because if Klaus Schwab and the United Nations and the world, Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum, and all the, if you like, the people who believe they're are controlling this particular agenda, where they want to bring in a lot of AI, they want to create. I have to say, you know, they what's going on in our hospitals and everywhere is genocide, in my view. They want to create a depopulated planet with AI, and they're very, very open about the Internet of Bodies, which is an extension of the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is the infrastructure that runs the systems of the smart cities. The Internet of Bodies is an extension of that, and that is how they hook up the AI. And look on the World Economic Forum, type in Internet of Bodies, they hook the AI up with the human being and intermingle the human flesh with the AI. So you're creating a cyborg, a half human, half machine person. Now, this is actually getting rid of the human being. And I'm not exaggerating this. This, I've researched this for such a long time now, and I really believe that we are on a knife edge, that if we don't fight this with all our might, then we will end up losing the human condition. And that is really, really important that we don't.
Okay, so I understand you feel strongly about this, but there are, you know, if we've looked at Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, much of this stuff hasn't really been achieved. You said so yourself. I mean, a lot of these things like the Internet of Bodies sounds like pie in the sky. Surely, mm-hmm. you know, this is very unlikely to happen. These are all pipe dreams that Klaus Schwab is having, and Prince Charles, and people involved in this great reset.
I don't think so. I don't think it's pie in the sky at all. This is what they want. This is the whole idea. And if you think about it, it can be achieved with the compliance of us, because most people are believing that this is a global pandemic, that every, you know, the governments and all the world governments are all trying to find a solution to. There will be no solution to this pandemic because they don't want one. It's a bit like, you know, cancer, they don't want to cure. This is going, COVID-19 is the virus that will keep giving. It's such a generous virus. It will keep replicating. It will keep, everything will just keep going, because they need the time to put all these infrastructures in. And what they'll do is they'll just keep us under lockdown after lockdown after lockdown. And at the moment, you know, it's just come out that, in fact, a leaked document from the government is saying that this lockdown won't finish till mid-July or end of July. And, you know, most people are thinking, oh, maybe they'll give us Easter. You know, we're hanging on the hope of we'll be able to have Easter. This is nonsense. It's you know, they're shutting, or, you know, any connection with our you know, our source, you know, by shutting churches and mosques and everything. You know, this is really worrying. The whole thing is worrying. And they do have the technology to create the half-human, half, you know, the cyborg, if you like, with the Internet of Bodies. And Elon Musk has been doing it. He said, you know, you can even do it wearing. They've said that there's ways of doing this, and do look on the World Economic Forum's website under Internet of Bodies. It's about wearing devices, being hooked up to devices, ingesting devices, which will actually change your DNA and change you to be able to be more receptive to the AI. And this is happening right now. This is not in the future. This is happening right now.
But they will say, won't they, look, and as Greta Thunberg will say, something that needs to be done about the climate. She will say that research data shows it, you know, it's warmer now than any other time in history. We keep hearing that, you know, the warmest day in this part of the world ever, that part of the world, that we, you know, we definitely have more man-made warming. I mean, that's obvious since man is having more activities. And that although so some people cite, you know, climate change going on in the past, the medieval warm period actually only affected certain areas of the Northern Hemisphere, and it wasn't actually warmer then than today. So, you know, that those are the sorts of arguments they will say, Sandy, you know, that the people behind these changes. And I wonder if can you actually refute what they're saying?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, at the moment, America and Canada have had the coldest weather they've ever had in, you know, harvesting in the snow. And what's really worrying is that the harvests that they export an awful lot of grains and stuff to China, they haven't actually got enough for them for their own country at the moment, and so it's actually how the harvests are going all over the world. And it's interesting that there's coffee growers in places quite high up in Myanmar and places like that have had to be putting polytunnels up to grow the coffee. There's going to be coffee shortages. There's going to be corn shortages. There's going to be grain wheat shortages. All of this is happening right now. So if you can, it's difficult for to actually say, well, it's all heating up exponentially. If you look at the global temperatures, they will, you know, they will skew it and say they're going up in order to roll out this agenda. And they're not. I mean, at the moment, we're headed for some very cold weather in England, and they'll say, oh, that's rubbish. But a few, you know, literally, 6 months ago, they're saying we will never see snow again. You know, this is
rubbish. I mean, you're based down in Glastonbury, near the Levels. I remember a few years ago there was a terrible flooding down there. You made reference to this at the beginning, saying that was a kind of a hoax. So what was going on there? I mean, I personally myself went down, you know, as a Bristol journalist, went down to have a look to see whether these, because they've got automatic sluices now, you know, the Levels were drained for centuries, and they've now got rid of the people that used to open them up at the right time of day to make sure all the water flowed out into the sea. It's all automatic now. It's some kind of, electronic thing that does it all. And I was quite annoyed to see that the drainage ditches were still full, even at low tide, and that the water was not being allowed out into the sea. So it's hardly surprising that the Levels were still flooded, and that had been going on for weeks. These things hadn't even moved. And so I just wonder what, you know, someone who lives in Glastonbury, which is right literally, you know, you look out your door, you can probably see the Levels, can't you? What was your take on what was going on then?
Well, it was interesting because I was down there doing some filming at first, but the rainfall had been going absolutely. It was relentless. It was more. It was heavier than the normal spring rainfall, and I was down there filming with someone that was needed a hand with some filming, and so I suddenly realised that there was a problem because the River Parrot was going up and up and up, and the locals had started sandbagging, and it was getting to the point where the parrot was going to burst its banks. And I said, look, I can't stand here and watch. So actually the film lot had to get back. And I thought, well, no, I'll stay in Sandbag. And so sandbagged right through the night, actually. And this was over a period of quite a few nights with sandbagging the and dates, sandbagging the and what was interesting is that there was no help. At that point, houses were flooding. The banks, you know, to a degree that the levels were the reens weren't draining, and there were people whose houses had been flooded, and there were farms where they'd had to take the livestock away, and the land was just, you know, just wet and revolting. And this was really interesting, because I thought, well, there was a company, a wonderful organization called CALSA, who were a Sikh organization, an aid organization, and they flew in from the Haiti earthquake to help the people of Somerset. But there was nobody from the Environment Agency around, nobody from the government, no army, no navy, nobody helping with that effort to actually help people. And it was based really around the local pub, which was amazing. The landlord of the local pub was incredible, the King Alfred at the bottom of Borough Mump. And, you know, they managed to get hold of blow-up boats and were rescuing people, and the village hall as well, where blankets were collected and people given cocoa and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, the upshot of it all was I'd been reading and understanding about Agenda 21 for a long time, and about the whole thing about sea level rise and all that stuff being, Niels Axel Mourner, he's a weather science, a sea level expert, and he'd debunked the whole sea level thing a long time ago, and been thrown out of the IPCC, I believe, for saying so. But anyway, what happened was I met a journalist down there called Christopher Booker, and he said to me, this is Agenda 21. And he said, just look up. He said, Policy 6, the Environment Agency. And he gave me a few little, I'd never met him before. But I then realised what an amazing man he was, because he'd been against the whole climate change thing. If you look at my website, I've got the his groupthink PDF on how the whole climate hoax happened. And it's the most comprehensive. If anybody really wants to know about why we're living with this whole global warming, climate change, nonsense. And I have to call it nonsense because it is. Look at his groupthink PDF, because it tells you exactly what happened at the Paris Climate Conference and everything. Anyway, he said, look at, and I was just green around the gills, really. So I looked it up, and sure enough, he was absolutely right. It came out of the Ramsar Treaty in 1971, where certain areas of the globe under agenda, it wasn't Agenda 21 in 1971, but it was this idea that certain areas of the globe should be flooded for biodiversity. And it then the Ramsar Treaty then became Baroness Young was put in charge of how the Agenda 21 should be implemented to actually flood certain areas of England and under the banner of biodiversity and sustainability for the wildlife, things like wading birds and wetlands. It was called the Wetlands Treaty. The Ramsar Treaty was all about the wetlands. And so what happened is that I then sort of did a bit more digging and found out that Baroness Young had actually at one point had said, Agenda 21, just add water, dear. And I thought, this is unbelievable that they're calling it an environmental programme. And yet I saw more devastation of wildlife on the Somerset levels, like hedgerows underwater, deers floating belly up down the River Parrot. It would devastated all the wildlife. And yet they were saying it was, and what had happened, actually, it was the reason why the levels had flooded was because the infrastructure, a bit like the whole levee thing in the New Orleans, which was the same agenda, was that the reens hadn't been dredged since the Environment Agency took over from, I think it was the farmers. And was it Matt, MAF or was it DEFRA? I can't remember.
There used to be something called the National Rivers Authority, actually.
Yeah, that, which... That's it. The National Rivers Authority. And the local farmers used to dredge the reams as well. So they knew that it would drain the levels properly so the livestock would be all right and wouldn't get...
So, if you don't dredge the reams... the drainage ditches, it's the reams is what they call them down there, and if you keep the sluices shut when at low tide, when the sea is out and then the water doesn't drain out from the levels into the sea at all, you can almost guarantee you're going to get a flood. So it is quite incredible, really.
Yeah, and what there were a number of things. They'd cut all the trees down along the River Parrot, which used to suck up the water. And along the reams, they'd cut all the trees down. There was pumping stations that had been degraded, just left to generally degrade. And there was another thing. There was a big, it was called the Royal Ordnance Factory. Was a big munitions factory that had been actually on the levels for many
years. Yeah, Bridgewater.
That's right. It was decommissioned. I think I can't remember the date it was decommissioned. But when they decommissioned it, because it was a steam factory, it sucked up a lot of water from the levels, and it was only decommissioned quite recently from when the floods happened. And they'd informed the Environment Agency and said, look, where is all this water going to go that we actually use up? And the Environment Agency had just neglected to even do anything about it. And so what happened, obviously, was a perfect storm of flooding, and 65 square miles of the Somerset levels were underwater. And that they haven't recovered. The houses in Boroughbridge, people lost their livelihoods, they lost their businesses, they lost their farms, they lost their homes. Some of their homes weren't insurable or insured under this. It was an act of God, apparently. So lots of people had problems, and the house prices there have never ever, they've stayed stagnant, and people cannot sell their houses there because it's still designated a floodplain. The Environment Agency were shamed. They came in and they built up the sides of the River Parrot, and they dredged the reams, and they were seen to be doing enough things to try and stop it. But they're still talking about the Somerset levels flooding now under sea level rise. And I went to a consultation meeting. It was just before the outbreak of this thing. And it's called Adapt 2020. And again, the Environment Agency are pushing, it's almost like predictive programming. They're holding these consultations to say to people, listen, I'm sorry, guys, the Somerset levels are going to flood due to sea level rise, which I know, due to Niels Axel Mourner's work, there is no sea level rise. Spoken to everything. He's written a whole paper on sea level rise and how it isn't happening. And what's happened is that they've the Environment Agency are now creating this whole, we've got to teach people how to adapt to the flooding of the Somerset levels. And really, they've got to think about moving elsewhere, which again is moving people off the land. I went to this consultation and I was absolutely horrified. I mean, they're talking about, perhaps you should put your houses on stilts, and perhaps you should put the farms on hills, instead. And I did challenge this guy at the Environment Agency, and I said, look, what makes you think that people can put their houses on stilts? Where is this? You're going to pay for relocating people?
So how does this fit in with this Agenda 2030 and Agenda 21 then? How do you think it does?
Land grabbing. It's about grabbing the land and making it people cannot live on that land. And, I wish I had the notes with me now, but there's another thing that I came across yesterday, which was a map of how much sea level rise will create flooding in Somerset. And there's a massive proportion of it was in red, which was the flooding area, including Glastonbury. And this is really about scaring people to move off the land. And they probably will flood it. They will run down the infrastructure again. But the thing is that it is about getting people off the land under sustainability and saying, well, actually, what we need is more areas for the beavers to be. And if it's wetter, the beavers will come back and the wading birds will come back. On this consultation, it was all about reintroducing animals into the wetlands, and that, sorry folks, you've got to move out, you've got to move your houses, you've got to put your houses on stilts. Or they even had a diagram of how you should organize your house so that all the electrical stuff is above the flood line, so when your house floods, which it will do, your television is on the wall very, very high. And it was ludicrous what they were proposing.
Well, it almost sounds as if what they're doing is reversing history. It's like mankind over the last 1,000 years or so has figured out how to reclaim this land, a bit like the Dutch have done, you know, in the Low Countries. They've made an amazing job of reclaiming that land, that they're now saying, oh, well, we're just going to let nature back in again.
Yeah. Exactly. And I did confront this guy from the Environment Agency there. And I said to him, is this another Policy 6? And he was very shocked that I knew about Policy 6. And that's the Environment Agency's Policy 6, which actually was interesting because it was drawn up. It was a map and it was drawn up in 1997 when Baroness Young instigated Policy 6, basically, with the Environment Agency. And that pink area on Policy 6 on the map is in the exact area, and that was designated as a floodplain in 1997, is the exact area that flooded on the Somerset levels in 2014. And that's when I realised that this is a plan. This is an absolute plan to again, just get rid of human beings off the land. To say, well, it's all to save nature. It's all about nature.
It sounds incredible. People being driven off the Somerset levels because they are so inconvenient as to want to live there and have lived there their families for generations. Yeah. But look, you know, one of the other things that's going on is there's a lot of talk now, particularly from Prince Charles, about something called zero carbon. So everybody has got to be zero carbon. Now, I don't quite really sure what that means, because I'm afraid I'm mostly made of carbon. So if you wanted to zero carbon me, there wouldn't be a lot left. But what does this expression mean, please, Sandy?
You know, I'm absolutely astounded, because it's almost as though we've been so dumbed down, we don't understand the difference between carbon monoxide and CO2. And what's happened is that, yeah, emissions, I mean, bad emissions are bad for you to breathe in and everything, and probably is bad for the, for creating some sort of warming of whatever, of the atmosphere. But CO2 is the gas of life. It's what makes trees and it makes life grow on the planet.
Well, hang on, I've got a CO2 detector in my living room, you know, just in case anything, because it can kill you, CO2, if you get too much of it coming out of a gas fire.
That's carbon monoxide. That's not CO2.
Oh, is it? Yeah. I've fallen into the same trap then, haven't I?
I've definitely fallen into the same trap, because CO2, it's funny, farmers at the moment, because they know that we've got a lot of cold weather coming, and also because of Brexit, we're not going to be importing, you know, tomatoes and things that we do from Europe, from the rest of, you know, the hot countries in Europe. They're creating polytunnels, and they're actually putting CO2 into the polytunnels to get the growing going. And actually, CO2, let's face it, is what we breathe out, and plants breathe in, and they give us oxygen in return. So there's been this absolutely ridiculous conflation between CO2 being something really, really bad, and not many people understand the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere, because most CO2 actually comes from the oceans. because it's I mean, I wish, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm only going by the fact that I went on tour with Piers and Mark for over 2 years talking about Agenda 21 and the whole climate lie, and how CO2 has been demonized as this terrible thing that we've got to have zero. If we had zero CO2, and they just call it carbon to kind of get you to think that it's something dirty. It's not. What they're doing is they're saying we have to get rid of CO2 completely. Well, if we did that, everything on this planet.
Well, no, I don't think they're saying that. They're saying that the levels of CO2 are actually affecting the sun's warming of the planet, and that we need to get those levels down again.
But they're saying zero CO2.
Well, what they're saying is, if you're carbon zero, I mean, I think this is what they're trying to say, is that if you are carbon zero, that means that you're not adding or taking away from the CO2 in the atmosphere. So in other words, if I, you know, spend my whole life driving around in a car or flying a jet plane, I'm going to be adding a lot to the CO2 out there.
Well, you know, to a degree, I'm sure that, you know, the thing is that we have been consuming too much and doing all that. We've got to come to a happy medium. But quite honestly, everybody wants to save the planet. But what they have in mind, what the people like the World Economic Forum, the United Nations have got in mind, is controlling us with a narrative that is not entirely truthful. And yes, you know, things do need to change. Like you said, we need to change, you know, the fact that we live in a corrupt banking system. We've got corrupt governments. We've got, we've got pollution in our seas. A lot of that is to do with overconsumption of bringing, you know, China, you know, plastic stuff from China. And that all has to stop. But the fact is that we are not going to die because of global warming. It is not what the real issue is.
So are Extinction Rebellion wasting their time?
Extinction Rebellion were basically financed by George Soros, and that's absolutely provable. He was, you know, hand in hand with Greta Thunberg, and that she was a tool, and I feel sorry for her because she is a child. Well, she was a child. She's not a child anymore. But she was used as a puppet to push this whole agenda that, you know, our house is on fire. You're going to die. Blah blah blah. You've only got so many years left, and there'll be nothing left. The whole thing is to push this technocratic global governance, one world government, one world currency agenda. And actually, what they did was, you know, Greta didn't work. You know, people were seeing through Extinction Rebellion. It was being called out. They had to do something. And actually, the pandemic, COVID-19, has given them, and they admit it, a wonderful opportunity to bring in the fourth industrial revolution, which is exactly what Greta was talking about for years. And so now we have all the things that they wanted to achieve happening. We've got basically people being told you can't use cash because it's covered in viruses. So people are using more cashless, you know, some shops won't even accept cash anymore. You know, you've got people not flying anywhere. You've got a whole industry on its knees. We are now in a prison of our own. You know, each nation is in its own prison now. We cannot have free movement. We have no freedom of speech. We have no freedom of movement. We're heading for a cashless society, and all the AI is coming in. And the trouble is that what is happening is the lockdown is a planned crash of the global economy to bring in that total control, to use data as the currency, and to data harvest everyone from cradle to grave with impact investing, which is about trading outcomes of a human being, their potential to actually be a functioning member of society who is not going to be a burden on society. So what happens to the people that are a burden on society, one has to ask? And so they're forcing our children with, by closing the schools, they're forcing them onto machine-driven learning in order to, we've got Goldman Sachs developing software for our children in school. And why would Goldman Sachs be interested in education? Because they've got impact investors actually gaining from that. The minute a child meets a milestone in their education that is actually forcing them through to this, an outcome that will benefit the military-industrial complex, then they get a token generated on the blockchain and the impact investor gets his reward. And this is all happening. This is, Tony Blair's involved in impact investing, Ronald Cohen in the States. They're actually there to create a commodity of the human being.
And wow. And interesting. Is this part of the Great Reset?
Yes, this is part of the Great Reset.
Well, it's that's an interesting idea. Investing is pretty scary. But look, these Extinction Rebellion people don't seem to like you, Sandy. In Stroud, when you came to speak in Stroud, they put up an internet post saying this Sandy Adams is a terrible person. She has quoted in the past on her website the anti-Semitic document, The Protocols of Zion. They also go on to say that that you had a 12-hour neo-Nazi propaganda documentary that contains Holocaust denial and very clear anti-Semitism on your website. So that's I'd just like you to answer that. What have you got to say to XR?
I will say to XR, well, you see, Stroud is heavily XR, as we know. To be honest, I am in at the moment in I don't know anything about the 12-hour documentary. But unfortunately, I employed a web hoster and he I'm going through a legal battle at the moment with him, which will come out. Sadly, I mean, it's pretty hideous, really. But I had someone who was my web host. I didn't realize that he'd anyway, it's a long story. But he put up an article on my website, which I took down and he put back up again. And he's a very and I'm going through a process where I'm taking legal action against him because he put up the only document that could possibly have upset them is one called The Truth is Anti-Semitic. And I didn't agree to that. I would never have agreed to that going on my website. And at the moment, I am in legal. He's now cloned my website and won't let go of it and is putting up all sorts of stuff. And so I've had to migrate my website.
What you're saying here really is that the stuff that they're accusing you of is something that somebody else has put up in your name rather than is something that you support.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and it's interesting that what they say is actually panning out, but that doesn't mean to say it's true. And I would never ever put anything on my website that would actually turn people away from the message that I'm trying to give. And this person did put it up on my website. I trusted them with
okay, my I suppose the best way to round up, Sandy, is to ask you about whereabouts people can find you. Obviously, this it might even say sandyadams.com or something, and it's actually not you. Somebody else is controlling
it. I'm trying to get hold of I've flagged it up with the abuse team at my original website server company, and I'm trying at the moment. This person has ownership of my website because I paid him to do it, but he's put it in his name, so he has ownership. Literally, my website's been hijacked by an individual.
Okay, so whereabouts can people find your stuff, Sandy? Because I'm sure you've got lots of interesting links and things.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very personal thing. But yeah, what's happened now is I've migrated my website, which is really my work, nobody else's, and nobody else can touch it because I've got total control over it. It's called sandyadams.net. And
can you spell that for us?
S-A-N-D-I, without any I-E or Y. It's S-A-N-D-I, Adams, ADAMS, .net.
And if there's one thing, you know, you could say to anybody about the current situation, just finally, what is that?
Well, the current situation, I do get sometimes a little bit sort of depressed about it, because it would seem that the mainstream media are holding all the cards and all the propaganda, you know, the BBC, ITV. BBC are appalling. At the moment, we're on this. We're literally, as I say, on this knife edge of truth versus, you know, not truth, illusion, or whatever, or misinformation. And I have to believe that we will actually get through this. But somehow, it has to penetrate the mainstream media. And people, I think it has to get a lot worse before it gets better, because people are accepting it, thinking it's going to go away. When they realise that having taken this vaccine, it doesn't stop transmission, it doesn't stop infection, and it doesn't stop you from, it still stops you from moving around freely. Maybe people will then say, well, why are they making us take it? You know, it's not even a vaccine, it's something else. It's something that literally changes your DNA. When people do finally realise, and I think all I can say to people is, if you are questioning it, maybe questioning it, even a small amount, and you're thinking, well, there's something wrong here, you know, look at the Light newspaper, look at UK Column, look at your work, look at my website. There's all the information is there for you to make up your own mind, because if you see all that information, you will realize that this is the biggest hoax that been forced onto humanity ever, and it is an evil thing to have done to all of us, and it is against the Nuremberg Code, it's against the Geneva Convention. It is absolutely 100% wrong and against our human rights and our constitutional rights. So, I mean, I don't know what else to say, really. I'm really absolutely devastated that it's got this far where, you know, it's rolling out the vaccine. And they'll say, oh, well, it's not mandatory, but then it will become mandatory because they change the rules constantly to just confuse us.
Well, I think they're coercing people, basically. This is what they're doing. I'm not so sure it will be mandatory. The idea is that your life becomes unbearable unless you have the vaccine, and you can only have your freedoms if you have the vaccine, this kind of thing. Yeah. Anyway, Sandy Adams, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony. Thanks for having me on.